Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, for the first time in U.S. history, drug overdose deaths outnumber lives claimed by traffic accidents here in the United States. Yes, that's right. And the opioid epidemic is now the deadliest drug crisis in American history. More than 150 Americans die every day as a result. It's the leading killer of people under the age of 50. Here's a statistic. It's since 1999, it's estimated the opioid epidemic has claimed more than 350,000 lives. My guest today is investigative journalist Chris McGreal. He's the author of a new book on this topic. It's called American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. In this book, Chris asks how a tragedy that began when Bill Clinton was president and swelled through the years of George W. Bush, only to begin to get attention it deserved as Barack Obama was wrapping up his second term. Chris McGreal is a veteran foreign reporter for The Guardian of Britain. He's a former correspondent based in Johannesburg, Jerusalem, Washington, D.C. He now reports from across the U.S., and he's received many awards for his coverage, for instance, of the Rwandan genocide, the Middle East, and the economic recession here in the United States from a few years ago. Chris McGreal, welcome to our studios here in Iowa.
Thank you.
You ask in this book how the greatest drug epidemic in American history was allowed to go virtually unchecked for nearly two decades with no end in sight. We're still in the throes of it now. You divide this book into three acts, Act One, Dealing, Act Two, Hooked, Act Three, Withdrawal. And before we have a little conversation about it, I'd like to have you read from the introduction of your book to get a sense of the narratives you weave into this tragedy. Would you start with a little bit from your introduction?
Certainly. The first time I looked into the face of opioid addiction, it was of a heavily made-up woman in her late 50s at a food bank in eastern Kentucky. Karen Jennings had once been a manager at McDonald's. Walking home, a little the worse for drink, she fell into a creek and broke her back. The doctor prescribed painkillers to ease her through the pain of recovery. Even as her injury healed, the narcotics drew Karen in. The drugs worked on her brain to demand ever larger doses of opioids with the promise of a few hours of bliss. If she failed to deliver, the narcotics exacted a perverse price. They caused her body to replicate the very pain they were supposed to fight. They tortured a fix out of her. With that, Karen's life spiraled into a perpetual hunt for pills, costing her job, destroying marriages, and taking a harsh toll on her family. She is haunted by a suspicion that her drug use contributed to the depression endured by her son, a bank vice president who took his own life. By the time Karen emerged from her addiction 15 years later, she was living on the breadline and amazed to find herself still alive. Karen Jennings's story was a personal tragedy, but that was not how she told it. She cast herself as a survivor plucked from a sea of dead, lost to a modern-day plague engulfing the communities around her. She was sucked in at the beginning in the late 1990s, just at what was to become the biggest drug epidemic in American history was taking hold. In time, the contagion infiltrated almost every corner of the United States.
Guardian journalist Chris McGreal reading from his new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. In this book, Chris, you mostly focus on West Virginia, and in particular, a town, Williamson, a population of less than 4,000 in Williamson. But as it turns out, that there is a lot of business for two pharmacies there with millions of prescription painkillers in the course of a decade. Start us off where you start this book, in West Virginia, and tell us the story of how this happened and when.
Yeah, Williamson, I chose Williamson because it's sort of at the center of the crucible of the epidemic. It's that part of Appalachia that the CDC has these maps which show from the late 1990s. They show how the overdose rate and deaths grew and they begin with a little red dot. And that dot over the years spreads across the country and gets redder and redder and pops up in different places. But it begins in that crucible of southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky. And the reason it begins there is that you have the drug companies, one drug company in particular, target that region to sell their opioid painkillers, and particularly the very high-strength drug OxyContin. And they choose that area because many people there, it's a part of the world where there's a lot of people already using some form of pain relief. They work on mines, they work in logging, there's a lot of physical toll on their bodies. And they looked at what painkillers were already being used. And that was an area that had a history of having used moonshine for pain relief or marijuana more recently, but also other low-level prescription pills and just over-the-counter pills. And so they targeted that area. And there's some very unusual demographics to this whole epidemic, but one of them is when you look at the early statistics, who becomes addicted, who overdoses, is middle-aged people. And of course, that would be those who would be most feeling the strains of long, hard life of physical work. And so they begin, they push their mass prescribing of these drugs as a safe alternative to other painkillers, as a strong and safe alternative. Mm-hmm. And they push it in this area, this part of West Virginia. And then what you see in somewhere like Williamson is you see people start to develop a dependency. Nobody told them just how dangerous these drugs were going to be. I talked to a man there, Willis Duncan. And I mean, I won't tell the whole story here, but Willis Duncan is a miner. He's an electrician on the mines. He's worked in them for 30 years. It's taken a toll on his body. He's been involved in a number of accidents, and he's involved in a fall. And he goes to the doctor and they prescribe opioid painkillers. And what Willis discovers is in time, because nobody told him how addictive they were, that he needs more and more of these drugs. Mm-hmm. And eventually his wife's in the same position. She has a hysterectomy. She gets given painkillers. She becomes dependent. Their son, until this whole family is just taking these prescription pills on a daily basis. And what you see that replicated across this region. And then you see people start to seize an opportunity to make money. And one of the reasons I chose Williamson is because it has one of the most notorious, what became known as pill mills in the area. Mm-hmm. A man called Henry Vincent, who appropriately had trained as an undertaker, arrives in this town, newly released from federal prison, having served 4 years for having run the biggest gay escort agency in Washington, D.C. He's released from prison. His parole officer requires him to go back and live with his mother in Williamson and to get a job. And Henry Vincent gets a job with a doctor. And he notices that these pills are being prescribed and he sees an opportunity. He gets an old warehouse and he starts to recruit doctors. Doctors who he obviously thinks are a bit dodgy and will do things that push the limits. And he installs them there to just prescribe pills to anybody that wants them.
Right. And when you say anybody, you say it's anybody. In your book, you describe, I have a picture, a mental image of what you describe of going to this town and at these doctor's offices, they do not care about your symptoms, right? They want to distribute these pills and even are not writing out proper prescriptions. They're just faxing lists to the pharmacies where people can go pick up their pills.
Yes. Well, the way the system worked was the doctor wanted to see you once and never again, except they wouldn't see your money, but not you. And so you went in once, you got your prescription, and the doctors had some very unusual pasts. The first doctor, or one of the first doctors that Henry Vincent recruits, is actually the physician from the federal prison he's just been released from. And another one is a doctor who's lost her license to practice in neighboring Kentucky for bribing a public official. Mm-hmm. And these various doctors are installed. And so they see you once, you pay your $150 cash to get your first prescription. And after that, all they want you to do is turn up at reception and pay the money, and you get the prescription without ever seeing them again, which is illegal, by the way.
And this word of this spreads like wildfire.
It does. And people are coming from far and wide. They're coming from Ohio. They're coming from Tennessee. They're coming from as far as Florida in some cases to get pills. And business gets to be so busy. There's thousands of people through this one building every day. As you say, what happens is the doctors simply send lists of names over to the pharmacies, who are making very large amounts of money themselves by now and are in on this, also acting illegally. They just fax over names. They don't even bother sending the prescriptions anymore.
If you've just joined us, Chris McGreal is my guest. He's the author of a new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. And Chris is an investigative journalist working for the Guardian newspaper of Britain. He spends his time here in the United States. He's been in many parts of the world. Fascinating book with a lot of narratives tracing back the origins of this. And we'll talk about it a little bit later. A tragedy that begins in the early days, we're talking about in the presidency of Bill Clinton, through the 8 years of George W. Bush, well into Barack Obama's presidency, before this is earnestly seen for the tragedy that it is, the deadliest drug crisis in American history. I want to go to the drug and have you sort of explain a little bit about OxyContin and why it was seen as, at least sold as, a safer painkiller. Was there any scientific basis to back that up? And how was it marketed in that way?
The answer is no, there wasn't. OxyContin came about because the manufacturer, Purdue Pharma, had latched on to... there was a changing attitude within medicine, particularly amongst some pain specialists, towards how you treat pain. And opioids had always been treated with great caution because they were regarded as addictive. Out of the UK, you'd actually seen the hospice movement come, which had broken down some of that barriers, because they said, if you're dying of cancer and great pain, it hardly matters if you become addicted. Mm-hmm. So the hospice movement transfers to the United States, and some doctors push for, well, not just prescribing, not just giving these high-strength opioids to the dying, but also people living with chronic pain, which can be very physically and mentally debilitating and very frustrating for physicians, that they haven't had ways to treat it. And what you see is the drug companies latch onto this. They see this movement and see an opportunity. And Purdue Pharma in particular decided that it needed to get a pill out there that would have unique properties, that would allow, give it something to market. And so it developed a very high-strength drug. Now, doctors are naturally cautious of a high-strength opioid because it's more likely to be addictive. And so what they say is they have this special coating mechanism that will mean that the drug will release itself very slowly into your system. And that will, one, be safer, because one of the reasons you become addicted to opioids is if you take them regularly, you get high peaks of the morphine in your system, and that helps create a dependency. The theory was with this OxyContin that it would bleed it much more slowly, so avoid those peaks and be safer. And also that it would be a better drug because it would last for 12 hours and you wouldn't have to wake up in the night and take it. And both of those claims were not only not fully investigated, there were no clinical trials, but they actually turned out not to be true. And the drug turned out to be actually more dangerous, not safer. But what Purdue Pharma was able to do was to persuade the Food and Drug Administration to endorse that without any checks. The Food and Drug Administration did indeed do that, and it put that on what's known as the label for the drug, which is what doctors look at when they prescribe it. And then Purdue Pharma goes out and says, oh, this is what the FDA says about the drug.
Use that. And did this massive marketing campaign you describe in your book, paying thousands of doctors, pharmacists, and nurses to speak on a tour of the country and spread the word about this supposedly safer painkiller, non-addictive?
And one of the things that was quite surprising to me when I was researching this book was how little training your ordinary doctors get in pain management, and particularly using addictive drugs like opioids to contain pain. So you had a situation where many of the doctors had a few hours at best of training, maybe a few days. So the drug company salesmen, who are not doctors, would turn up, Purdue's sales force would turn up, making claims for these drugs. And effectively, the doctors were getting their training, their information on how to use these drugs from the Purdue sales force. And when doctors raised questions like addiction and all of the rest, they were told not only had the FDA said that these were safer, but they were actually sold what is essentially junk science. They were told, no, there's evidence that, in fact, there's something called pseudo-addiction, mm-hmm. which what looks like addiction isn't really addiction. It's the pain speaking. So actually what you do is give people who look addicted more drugs.
Right.
And doctors went along with this.
We're talking about doctors as if they're one group, a monolith,
so
to speak. So I imagine there's a spectrum of reaction among doctors across the country. Some were more skeptical, even in the face of this kind of marketing and these supposed claims here. So pull that apart a little bit. There were whistleblowers, those who suspected this is not really good for my patients.
Yes, I think what we're talking about is the bulk of primary care doctors who wanted to do the right thing. They genuinely, most doctors were not like those I've just described in Williamson. They were just the opportunists.
Right.
But most doctors want to do the right thing. They just don't have the information. But you're quite right. One of the things that had really surprised me was how is it that this epidemic ran on for 2 decades before anybody really talked about it? Where were people ringing the alarm bell? Mm-hmm. How did they not notice? And it turns out that indeed there were plenty of doctors ringing the alarm bell. There was a doctor called Art Van See, who was the primary health care doctor in a very small mining town in Virginia called St. Charles. There was a doctor called a pain specialist called Jane Ballantyne, who was head of pain management at Harvard University and at its associated hospital, Massachusetts General. And she was actually following this advice about prescribing and upping doses. But she started to see that her patients were not only were they not in less pain, she kept increasing the dosage, but the pain kept coming back. And she thought, that's not supposed to be happening. But actually, the more drugs they got, the less quality of life they had. So she started to ask questions. And eventually, in 2003, 6 years after OxyContin comes onto the market, she publishes a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine saying, wait a minute, these drugs actually aren't doing what they're supposed to do. Yes, they may work short term, but long term, we think they're creating real problems for patients. Mm-hmm. And at that point, that's what's so interesting. There were other doctors too. At that point, that was the moment. That was the opportunity for the industry and for the medical profession to say, let's take a step back here. You see the opposite happen.
So it was not an inflection point that it might have been.
Precisely. You see the drug companies suddenly wake up and go, oh, there's a threat to our sales here, to our money, to, as a senator put it to me, to our candy. They want to take
right.
our candy
and
away.
And when you say money, describe a little bit how much money is Purdue Pharma making here.
Well, by 2003, it was pulling in about $2 billion a year from OxyContin.
$2 billion.
And it's not alone. I mean, there are other drugs, oxycodone and hydrocodone drugs, which between them were pulling in about $1 billion a year for other drug makers. So everybody's making very large amounts of money on the back of this. Mm-hmm. And the prescribing ratchets up. It just gets, you know, it just it escalates through those years.
And so we have the opioid overdose death count soaring, mm-hmm. addictions soaring. And then this study, you say, comes out. How did Purdue Pharma respond in the face of this criticism and claim of junk science?
Well, I think one of the things it becomes clear at that point is it's no longer just Purdue Pharma. They're clearly making a lot of money. But because even though their drug is the most the strongest, it's not actually the most pervasive by then. Lower level opioids are also being very, very widely prescribed. And what you see is the drug manufacturers really start to act together. It's more than just Purdue. And their response is to try and blame the victims. What they decide is we need to change the conversation here. And so they start pointing the finger at those they call the addicts and the abusers and saying, well, it's their own fault they've become addicted. They're not following their prescriptions. And we mustn't allow that, those abusers, to take away the drugs from the good patients, the people that need them. And they paint this in black and white terms. And of course, one of the things about that is that many of those people who do become addicted and who do indeed go on to abuse the drugs and buy them on the black market had begun by taking them through prescriptions without any warning from their doctors that they may be addictive. And they had gone on ratcheting up doses on the basis of what their doctors were telling them. So this attempt to paint the victims as though that it's their own fault. But it was a very effective attempt. And it's summed up in one phrase. They use the phrase balanced approach. We must have a balanced approach. And of course, as many doctors said to me, that was really what by balance they just meant keep the doors open to mass prescribing.
Mm-hmm. We have another drug here I'd like to have you comment on briefly before we take a break here. We hear later in this tragedy, fentanyl mentioned. How does fentanyl fit into this history in relation to OxyContin and the other opioids?
Well, what you see is many people who begin on prescription drugs, as time goes by, if they find it hard to get them either through prescription or on the black market, they look elsewhere. And the Mexican drug cartels were aware of this, and they start to push heroin into the country because essentially, as the DEA said to me, these prescription pills are little more than heroin in a pill. And so heroin starts to move in big time into the country in the late 2000s, and it starts in many places to supplant the prescription pills for those who've become addicted. And then heroin is quite a difficult thing to manufacture. You've got to grow the poppies, and then you've got to smuggle it across the border, and it's bulky, right? So the cartels looked around for an alternative, and they found something that's mostly manufactured in China for the purposes of smuggling. They found an artificial opioid called fentanyl. It's around 100 times stronger than heroin, and it means it can be used in much smaller quantities. It can literally be put in the mail from China and posted to the United States, and they started feeding it in to the heroin, to strengthen the heroin, and they would mix flour in there as well, so it looked bulky, but it got its strength from the fentanyl. And then as time goes by, fentanyl just becomes more and more important and accounts for more and more deaths.
Well, Chris McGreal, this is fascinating. We have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is investigative journalist Chris McGreal of The Guardian. He has a book out called American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. And he looks at this, tracing it way back into the start in the Bill Clinton administration through George W. Bush and Barack Obama's administration, actually recognized as a huge threat, or at least the president not publicly saying it was a huge threat, Chris, if I'm right, until later in his presidency. We'll talk about that when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest today, investigative journalist Chris McGreal of The Guardian. His new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. So, Chris, we spent the first part of it talking about how this started. You focus a lot on West Virginia. And it's just so surprising as a reader of this book when we talk about how this blossomed and reaped so many addicts, so many deaths, ruined so many families. And we have this organization called the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, and we have Congress. We seem to think that we would have a safety net to prevent such a thing happening. What failed?
Well, that was one of the things that really struck me when I was researching this. I thought you know, how is it that this has gone on for so long? Where were those institutions that are supposed to protect Americans? Because it's quite apparent, at least in parts of the country, that by the early 2000s, there were plenty of politicians, there were plenty of doctors that knew exactly what was going on. And so where was the Food and Drug Administration? Where were the politicians? And what I discovered was how much, when the drug companies took control, essentially, of medical policy and the narrative, they brought on board the federal institutions in this idea that we mustn't take away opioid prescription pills from those people that need it. And what you see with the FDA is it gets locked in to this mentality that we have to keep the prescribing open. There was actually within the FDA, there was a movement, a real push to take broader public health considerations about opioid addiction on board. But there was a real resistance in that section of the FDA that approves opioids. And it just kept approving more and more opioids to go onto the market for even relatively moderate pain, high-strength opioids. And when I delved into why this was and what had gone wrong, there were people who used to be in the FDA and there are people still in the organization who said to me that in time that they felt that the FDA had developed a much too close relationship with the industry. Mm-hmm. There was a time back in the early 60s when, in fact, the FDA was an example to the world of how you regulate drugs because it kept people of a certain age will remember a drug called thalidomide, which caused a lot of birth deformities in Europe. And the FDA kept it off the market in the United States. And that led to the agency getting a lot of power to control drugs. But in time, that became eroded. It became eroded partly by the urgency of the AIDS epidemic and the need to get drugs onto the market much quicker, and quite rightly so. But it also became eroded because a financial relationship built up in which, from the 1990s, drug companies started to pay the FDA for essentially licensing the drugs. And we get to a point where today, that part of the FDA that licenses opioids gets 75% of its income from the drug companies. Mm. And
so we have a systemic problem here.
I think so. And one of the things is people said to me that the FDA doesn't always see this, but actually it's gone from regulator and regulated to kind of a business client relationship. It regards the drug companies as its clients. And of course, the drug companies use that fact that they pay so much money to the FDA to exert political pressure as well. That, and it, you know, it hasn't gone unnoticed that the pharmaceutical industry is one of the largest contributors on Capitol Hill to lobbying and to congressional campaigns and all of the rest. So you see vast amounts of money flowing through the system, and you see it influencing this policy, this medical policy, at every point, but also containing any attempt to rein in mass prescribing.
Chris McGreal is my guest this hour. American Overdose is his book, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. I wanted to play a little clip here of President Obama addressing the opioid crisis. And as a working journalist myself in this time, and listeners will know that we really didn't start talking about this as a national epidemic, the epidemic that it is, surpassing the number of deaths in road traffic accidents in the U.S. not too long ago. We didn't start talking about this until late in the Obama presidency. Let's play a little bit of President Obama, I believe from 2015, and then have you explain how it finally reached the lips of a president late in his second term. Let's hear President Obama from 2015.
4 in 5 new heroin users, started out by misusing prescription drugs. Then they switched to heroin. So this really is a gateway drug. The prescription drugs become a gateway to heroin. As a consequence, between 2002 and 2013, the number of heroin-related deaths in America nearly quadrupled, although the number of heroin-related overdoses is still far exceeded by the number of legal prescription drug overdoses.
So, Chris, this starts in the 90s through the entire George W. Bush presidency, 8 years there, and then only late in the Obama presidency is it addressed seriously. What happened? Why wouldn't presidents address it and speak publicly about it as a national epidemic until late in the Obama presidency?
Well, I just say one thing about what Obama said there. He misspoke. He said 4 out of 5 begin by misusing drugs. That's not strictly true. Many of that 4 out of 5 will have begun by legitimately using prescription drugs and then gone on to misuse them. It's not that they began by misusing drugs, but which is, I think, an important thing here, because the drug companies often want to push the idea that people begin by misusing.
And this is the idea that also too important in what you say is this can be your neighbor, and very often is your neighbor, and not someone you recognize as someone in an alley who's very different from you.
Yes, and I think that partly speaks to your question here, which is, how did it go on? I think for several reasons, one of which is, if we look at those areas that it began in, that I was talking about, West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, I think that they're marginalized in the United States. I think they're invisible to lots of the country. And I think the communities there are generally stigmatized and ignored and blamed for their condition frequently, whether that's poverty or drug addiction. So I think it was quite easy for the rest of the country to look away. And even where they saw it, which most of them didn't, they said to themselves, well, that's them, that's not us.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we start to see things to change is when people realize, oh, that's us too. And I think that was a slow process, partly because of stigma, particularly around heroin, which in this country has a history of being a racialized drug and associated with a black urban epidemic previously. And I think, for instance, of a woman in Northern California whose son died of a prescription opioid overdose, April Rivero. And she's from a very wealthy community in the San Ramon Valley. And when her son died of an overdose of drugs he obtained illegally from a doctor, she was really shocked. She had never even heard of the epidemic. This is 2009. But when she looks around, she discovers there are 58 other opioid deaths in the 3 years previously in the three communities in her valley. And she determines to go out and speak about this because nobody else has, because of stigma. And I think perhaps it's now touched so many lives that it has made it possible to speak about it, and that brought it to the fore. Another one is former Congresswoman Mary Bono. She was married to Sonny Bono, and she's a widow of Sonny Bono. Their son became addicted. And when she was in Congress, she helped form a committee to focus on this. And she talks about the long battles she had to get anybody to pay attention. But it was only drawn to her attention, she admits, because her own son was drawn into the epidemic.
Right. And the stories you tell remind me of people I've had as guests on this very program, Chris. Courageous people. A mother, in this case, her son died of an overdose. And she had the courage to tell her story. She had the courage to testify before our legislature. So this is echoed in states, I imagine, all across the country. These personal testimonies and recognizing on radio, on television, in print, that these are our neighbors and this can happen to you, this can happen to your son or daughter.
Yes, and they're some of the real heroes of the story. I mean, there are some great heroes in my book. You see these people who face up to this enormous tragedy in their lives by going out and fighting to prevent it happening to other people. And for many, many years, they were kind of fighting on their own. But they laid the ground for these discussions that we are now having.
Mm-hmm. Chris McGreal is my guest, investigative journalist. His book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. I wanted to run this by you, and I know you're on a book tour coming through Iowa. I don't know how well acquainted you are with Iowa's laws that have answered the opioid epidemic, but in May of 2018, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law a comprehensive bill aimed to combat the opioid epidemic, mostly from the standpoint of curbing prescription drug abuse. Among its provisions, the new law requires prescribers, these doctors, dentists, nurse practitioners, and veterinarians to register for the prescription monitoring program. It's an online database that will receive funding from this bill. And so it's tracking these. There are other details here which I'm not mentioning. I wonder your reaction to this. Does this sound like a plan to you? Is this something that other states are springing into action to do? Will it be effective in your judgment?
I think it's lots of parts of the puzzle. You know, there's not one answer here. But certainly, what distinguishes the United States, and one of the reasons this is called American overdose, is that this is a pretty much uniquely American problem. There's a little bit something similar in Canada, but you don't see this in other developed countries. There is no opioid epidemic of this kind in Europe or in Japan.
Why is it uniquely American?
Well, there are I dig deep into that in the United States, and again, there are some unique aspects of the United States. I mean, from one perspective, I would say it's because medicine in the United States is an industry. In most other developed countries which have public health systems, you have a different structure. It's in essence, what happened in the US is that you had the people who were making the money, the drug companies, and for that matter, the insurance companies, writing medical policy. Medical policy isn't written in the same way in other countries. So that's one important aspect. I think there are other elements to it. There is what is now regarded as the pill for every ill mentality in the United States. Mm-hmm. Americans take prescription drugs at a much higher rate in general than other countries.
And that's just something we grow up with, that idea that pills can solve this or that medical ailment.
Well, yes, that's true, although it's certainly been enhanced by the fact the United States is only one of two countries in the world, the other one being New Zealand, which permit drug advertising.
Right. So, we think drug advertising is ubiquitous around the world. It's not.
No, it doesn't exist anywhere except here in New Zealand.
So it's as strange as us going to a country and seeing an advertisement for a cigarette, because those are banned here.
Precisely. And doctors would talk to you about, you know, that started in 1997, and they talked to you about the impact of that's had. And they said, they see many patients now come to them, and they've seen these ads, and they've decided they need this pill. And again, because people pay so much for their health insurance in this country, you know, yes, they're patients, but they also to some degree regard themselves as clients, and they want the doctor to do as they tell them.
Yes.
And then you have, you know, all of this is enhanced by the whole patient satisfaction surveys.
Must be a horrible frustration for well-meaning doctors with ethics.
Well, what they say is it's really, really difficult because, for instance, if somebody's in pain, maybe it's got to do with their lack of exercise, their lifestyle, what they eat. They're all kinds of contributors, but they come in and they want a painkiller. And they're told, firstly, the doctors are under pressure from the hospitals themselves to keep the patients happy, but they're also under pressure from the insurance companies, which want the cheapest and easiest as far as they're concerned. And the thing about those pills is they're cheap, and their patients in and out the door in 10 or 15 minutes. If you've got to sit down and talk to them about their lifestyle, get them exercising, perhaps get them physical therapy or treatment for their stress, that's a much more expensive option. So for many years, the insurance companies are backing away from this now, but for many years, that was the priority. So you see forces at work in the United States that you don't really see elsewhere.
Where are we now? Chris McGreal, my guest, we're coming to the end of our conversation, American Overdose, his book, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. Where are we in the U.S. now in stemming this epidemic? Is that too strong of a word to describe what's happening now? How are we doing in terms of coping with this problem?
Well, I think in part it returns you to your original question about what Iowa is doing and other states are doing. I mean, we still have an absolute failure of national leadership on this, really. President Trump has certainly done better than any of his predecessors in that he appointed a commission that came up with a very good report. It identified the causes and some of the solutions. But as much as it may sound, the $8 billion allocated to deal with the epidemic is actually quite a small amount given the enormous challenges of treatment and coping with. There's probably 2 million people who are dependent on these drugs now. But more importantly, you want to prevent a new wave of people becoming addicted. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, although prescribing has fallen, prescribing has only fallen by about 20%. At its peak, there were about 250 million opioid prescriptions written every year. That was 2012. That's one for every adult in the country. It's fallen to 190 million, which is good. It's down, but it's still at 3, 4, 5 times the rate of most European countries. So if you're not going to curb prescribing, then you're not going to you know, deal with some of the roots of the problem. And the FDA is continuing to put more drugs on the market. And so I think there is definitely progress. Awareness is obviously really important. Doctors are more aware and patients are aware of the dangers. I speak to many people who say now they would be very cautious about taking those drugs. But even so, I think this is a really long-term crisis. It has a long tail. And I think that there's still a lot of important steps to be taken before you've dealt with the root causes.
Mm-hmm. When we have a problem of this magnitude in the country, we rely in part on new legislation, actions by elected officials here. And as you well know, in this country, we have huge problems. Everybody agrees there's an immigration problem. We need an overhaul in our immigration policy. That is terribly partisan in how you react to that and what you see as a solution. Is this a partisan issue as far as you can tell in state governments, in the federal government? You talked about Donald Trump, about Barack Obama. We've seen it through presidents of both parties. Do you see this as having that also as a barrier to a solution?
No, I don't think it has been a partisan issue. In fact, I think that the industry, drug industry and the medical profession was very good at uniting both Republicans and Democrats in Congress against anything that would prevent the continued mass prescribing of pills. Mary Bono, with a Republican legislator from the congressman from Eastern Kentucky, Hal Rogers, who rang the bell on this, the alarm bell on this very early, they tried to get through legislation to require doctors to have training in opioid prescribing, which seems under the circumstances quite a reasonable requirement. And that was vigorously opposed by the American Medical Association, and it was very strongly voted down by both Democrats and Republicans. So I don't think this has been a partisan issue. I think the response really has depended largely on how badly a region has been affected. So a state like Ohio, which has been very badly affected, mm-hmm. it now has legislation restricting prescribing of drugs to 3 to 5 days on the whole.
And Iowa fitting in that spectrum is a fairly mild repercussions here, if we can talk about that. It's not nice for anyone who's had a death in their family to an opioid addiction, but Iowa is one of the lesser affected states.
What you don't see in Iowa is what you do see in parts of New England, like Maine, in Ohio, in West Virginia and Kentucky, those places where his entire communities are ravaged by this. And it has distorted these communities. I used to be a reporter in Africa. I was a correspondent at The Guardian in Africa for 15 years. And in the early 90s, I used to go to Uganda. And you go to these villages where there was a missing generation because of AIDS. And the children were being brought up by their grandparents. You can find that in West Virginia. Mm. And so you're not seeing that in Iowa to the extent that you see it in places like West Virginia. But that doesn't mean to say, obviously, as you say, that, you know, there aren't plenty of families that are deeply traumatized by this.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute or so left to end here our conversation, Chris, with lessons you've learned and all the research that you've put in here, takeaways here, perhaps having to do with commercial interests and medical policy. What can be learned from this tragedy, which, as you say, will have a tail that extends out decades from now?
Well, I think the big lesson for me is that medical policy should be controlled by the medical profession. And that's clearly not what happened here. Medical policy on pain management was driven by commercial interests, which bought essentially mass prescribing. And very effectively so. They got it into hospitals. They got it through state medical boards. But it was driven by financial interests. And I think that is the one thing, more than anything, I would like to see. I'm not sure that that's going to change because I'm not really sure that those structural lessons are being learned. What we're seeing now is people quite rightly criticize Purdue Pharma for what it's done with OxyContin. But it's very convenient for a lot of other interests to now have one drug company take the blame for all of this. And it's not. Purdue Pharma did what it did because it was allowed to get away with it. And I think that a lot of doctors out there feel the same way. They'd like to be the ones that decide medical policy rather than the drug companies and the insurance companies and everybody else. So that for me would be the big takeaway. But there are a lot of smaller lessons. And I think partly, you know, there are social economic lessons about the help that people need when they become addicted. And I think about communities and how you strengthen communities.
What's next for Chris McGreal? What are you investigating now? Can you say?
I write a lot about the opioid epidemic still. I'm looking at the continued role of the FDA in approving these drugs. And I look, to be honest, these days, a lot of the impact of the broader social impact of these drugs on communities and what it's done to them, the politics of it. That's for now where my focus is. I do have the germ of an idea for another book, but I'll keep that to myself for now.
All right, Chris, thank you. Chris McGreal. The book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. Chris is a veteran foreign reporter for The Guardian with numerous awards and working around the world and as of late roaming the United States. And I want to thank you very much for this conversation, Chris. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.